Are you familiar with the story of Amelia Earhart? She dates back for some of us, I'll have to actually say for some of you, to when you were quite young. She was probably one of the two most famous women in all of America, along with Mrs. Roosevelt. She was a pioneer in the air industry. She was the first woman pilot to do many things, to fly solo from the United States to Europe, the first person of all, man or woman, to fly nonstop solo from Hawaii to the continental United States, and held numerous other firsts and records of various kinds as a pilot. On top of that, she was a best-selling author. She often wrote about the things that she had done, and those books were wildly popular. She appeared all across the United States, in fact, all around the world, speaking to large, enthusiastic audiences about her unique skills and career that she had. She joined Purdue University as part of their faculty to teach there. But in spite of all of that, she's remembered most for what she didn't do. In late 1936, she and two co-pilots began a journey around the world. She was going to fly around the world. She had a specially built airplane built called an Electra just for their use. Their flight began in Oakland, California, and they flew from there to Miami, Florida, and then down to South America, then across to Africa, from Africa to India, and then to New Guinea in the southeastern part off the coast of Asia. The next leg of the flight was going to take them from New Guinea to Hawaii, but they were going to have to stop partway along that journey because that's such a long distance. 2,000 miles away from New Guinea was an island called Howland Island, an established air base and a place where they could land and refuel and so forth. But they never reached Howland Island. Radio contact was sketchy. It was clear that they couldn't find the island, that somehow their direction finders and other things that they were using in 1937 were not getting them where they wanted to be. They were in communication from time to time with the island and with ships offshore who were watching for them, but they never arrived. Since that time, there's been a great mystery about what happened to them. All sorts of things have been put forward. Some have gone so far as to saying that she was really spying for the American government and that the Japanese sabotaged somehow the whole affair and they were the cause of her disappearance and death, even though no plane, no body or anything was ever recovered. And truthfully, very little or no evidence actually that she was in any way connected with spying for the United States government. Others have suggested that she actually did arrive somewhere and actually made it back to the United States and then lived the rest of her life as a housewife in New Jersey. Again, no evidence to support that, just a myth. The two most commonly believed things about this ill-fated flight of hers is that either, number one, she and her two co-pilots and her plane crashed somewhere in the Pacific. This is a vast water with very little in the way of land anywhere. And so they were lost forever at sea. Or, number two, that they managed to reach not Howland Island, but another island some 350 miles southeast of Howland called Gardiner Island. That either they crashed, landed there, and lived a few years before they died, or perhaps died in the crash. That's been in the news lately because there's been a great deal of research going on in the last few years by an organization called the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, a well-recognized and honored and long-standing organization, in which they're trying to prove or disprove whether or not they actually reached this Gardiner Island. And later, I understand this summer, there's actually going to be a special on the Discovery Channel on the cable networks talking about where that research is at this present moment. Even as we speak, I understand there are diving crews and high-tech equipment all at work off the coast of Gardiner Island looking for the possible remains of the plane in the waters there. in an effort to establish that. But some tantalizing things have already been discovered. On this island, which is only some 3 miles long and 1 mile wide at its widest, and that has no fresh drinking water on it of a permanent nature, only water that can be caught from rain, it's uninhabited. It was inhabited for a short time in the 40s and 50s when the British tried to make it a permanent place, but it finally was abandoned because of it was so remote and there was no water and they just could not sustain life there. There was a radar, or not really a radar unit, but a spotting unit that was placed there by the U.S. Navy during World War II to watch out for any enemy planes or others that might be flying anywhere near the island, but that, of course, was withdrawn as soon as the war was over. And so there has been some other human habitation, even though temporarily, there on the island. But what has been discovered in the last few years is a small piece of an aluminum panel of the same kind of aluminum that the Electra was made out of, a piece of plexiglass consistent with the kind of material that the windshield of the Electra was made from, the heel of a woman's shoe consistent with the kind of shoes that Amelia Earhart loved to wear when she was flying, 5 fragments of glass that when put together make up a good portion of a small jar that was widely used in the 1930s and in which a very popular freckle remover cream was sold. And Amelia Earhart was famous for being very freckle-faced and hating it. Part of a pocket knife. Several places on the southern uninhabited, never uninhabited part of the island in which campfires had been built and had been maintained for significant periods of time. Several glass bottles dating from the 1930s before any other inhabitants were on the island. And some fragments of a mirror, including certain kind of special beveled edges, the same kind of mirror that was in the compact that Amelia Earhart was known to use. But does this prove she was there? That's the question. They're clues. They're evidence, perhaps, of something, but not yet conclusive. And there are those who question the whole thing. There's a very prominent man, none of us would recognize his name, but who calls the whole thing just hogwash, bunk, that somebody with an agenda is trying to push an idea that has no evidence to support it. Well, I suspect if they do happen to find a plane off the coast of Gardner Island, it is an Electra, that will probably tend to put a lot of doubts to rest. And if they don't, the doubts will remain. But why am I talking about this? This isn't our message for the day. We're talking about what evidence does. What do clues help us to do? They help us to move closer to conclusions about the truth or untruth of something. And the lack of those clues and evidence, or clues and evidence of a contrary nature, will lead us in a different direction. So far, it seems everything they've discovered, or at least everything that I've been able to read that they've been willing to reveal, is moving in the direction of supporting the belief that the plane either crashed on or just off of the island, and that at least one, maybe more, of those on board that plane, there were 3 altogether, survived for at least a short time. And did I mention the skeleton they found in 1940? It was later taken to the Fiji Islands for examination, and it was determined that it was a skeleton of a man. But sadly, somewhere along the way, in the very efficient system the Fijians have, the skeleton's been lost now. But we mention all of these things, and something that's in the news right now, if you watch for it, to remind us that we're studying about the evidence for the existence of God. And there are things that we look at that at least in our mind move us either in the direction of believing more and more in the existence of an eternal, all-powerful Creator God, or in an opposite direction. And we recognize that there are those in an unbelieving camp who put forth arguments saying that scientific discoveries and various theories and hypotheses can now be constructed about the origins, for example, of our universe, the origins of life, and the ongoing, what they call, process of biological evolution, they say, which eliminates now the need for God to explain these things. But in fact, what all these proposals they put forward do is does not prove there is no God, but rather only provides another possible, and I believe highly unlikely, alternate explanation for all these things. And these things in and of themselves are not actually scientific, because it's dealing with things that are unseen and unknowable directly. And the whole purpose of science is to study that which can be seen. And yet when you talk about the origins of the universe, the origins of life, the origins of consciousness in the human race, all of those predate any efforts of science to discover direct scientific evidence. I have an author I like to read after by the name of Lee Strobel, which, by the way, is a former atheist and a man highly trained in two fields, the legal profession, so he had to deal with evidence all the time, and in the journalistic profession, again, as a journalist who covered the legal beat in Chicago for many years, he had to be fully cognizant of how evidence works and how presentations of cases are made to either prove or disprove things. And in one of his books called The Case for a Creator, I've roughly paraphrased what he sums up in his book about the arguments being made by the unbelieving camp. He says, they propose that nothing produced everything. They propose that non-life produced life. They strongly urge that randomness and chaos ended up producing order and design, and that non-intelligence, non-consciousness of any kind produced intelligence and consciousness. Now that can be said over against the belief that we have, not only us as Christians, but the Jewish people, even the Islamic people. And the biblical view is that there is a creator, a life giver, a designer, and an eternal consciousness and intelligence that produce these things. And so we've looked at several of the clues and evidences that, to us at least, clearly weighs in that direction. And with most cases involving evidence and conclusions that are drawn from it, different people are persuaded by different parts of the evidence. For some, you know, we've already mentioned this, I think, about the famous O.J. Simpson murder trial. It looked like the prosecution had everything going their way until O.J. Simpson couldn't get that glove on his hand, the glove that they had already linked so strongly to the murder. And for many, that turned the case right there. The evidence seemed to be pointing this direction, and many other things went in that direction. Another thing that changed it for other people was this man, Mark Furman, that got put on the stand, who was testifying so strongly against Simpson and was a key, not witness to the crime, because there was no witness that lived, but rather was a key investigator in the whole thing. And then it turned out that this man was, shall we use the word, crook. He was, even though he was a law officer, he was involved in all sorts of illegal things and had done all sorts of wrong things. And so many ended up being convinced, whether Simpson did the crime or not, you can't trust this man in anything he says. And in the same way we were just talking about with Amelia Earhart, if they find the plane, that probably will be the tipping point for many people. Others are already convinced with the evidence that does exist. And so as we've talked about these several things already, the existence of the universe and how did it come into existence, the existence of life and how did it come into existence, the proliferation of not just life itself, but of intelligence. Either it came out of total non-intelligence or it came from one who was intelligent. There seems to be no other choice. And great order and design in the universe, either that came out of chaos and total randomness all on its own, or there was one great designer and arranger who made it all that way. And so we look at one more piece of evidence or clue this morning. And for some, this is very convincing. In fact, just about, I guess, maybe 3 weeks ago, I sent an article on to Don. about a fairly famous atheist. She's made her mark mostly on the internet by running a very large website that constantly was promoting the atheistic view and so forth. And she suddenly announced on her website that she was not only abandoning her website, she was abandoning her atheism, because she said she could no longer sustain the idea that the absolute sense of right and wrong and morality was simply the result of evolution. For many people, the fact that we have innately within us a sense of right and wrong is a compelling clue or evidence for the existence of a great lawgiver. For we look in all the rest of nature, and no other living creature, as far as we can tell, has any such sense at all. Yes, all of the creatures in nature seem to be guided very much by nature, and some of them have a certain amount of intelligence as they are guided by their innate natures and these things that are built into them. The geese and ducks fly south for the winter, and bears hibernate, and all of these kind of things that are a part of their nature. But that seems to have nothing to do with right and wrong or any sense of good and evil. Only mankind. And what's so amazing about it is not only does this exist among mankind, but it exists among all mankind throughout all of our known history. And in the root fundamental elements of it, it is consistently the same. Everywhere you look at man in all of history, you find that protection of one's personal property is expected. In other words, theft, robbery, taking something away from someone else simply because you're bigger or more powerful or stronger or in a better position than they are, is condemned. Human life is valued. You don't kill another person. Another person's body is protected. You don't cut their nose off either, or their ear, or their hand. Now, yeah, there's plenty of people who have done those kind of things to other people, but all the rest of culture and mankind condemns it. We hold to the sanctity of the man-woman marriage relationship. Ever how primitive, ever how advanced we are, and many other such things as that. The value of truth and the horror of lying or bearing false witness about other people. And it's only when people abandon the idea that there is a supreme lawgiver who has not only innately put this within each one of us, but is holding us accountable for it, that men then start to change all of this and say there is no such thing as absolute right and wrong. It's only what we want to make it. It's only what we want it to be. And in fact, when you look at the whole idea of everything coming from strictly natural causes, nothing producing something and non-life producing life, then when you go to the same people, you will hear them either say that this somehow arose naturally and we eventually will find some way to explain it without including God in it, or else they will say the whole idea of right and wrong is just an illusion and doesn't really exist at all. Dennis McCollum, who's a right now a fairly popular author in the Christian community, and both has worked with a large church ministry up in Ohio, I believe it is, and one of his books called Discovering God said, "Naturalists who don't believe in God think the universe is nothing more than particles and energy. But such a view cannot teach us that child abuse is wrong or that human life matters. Quite the contrary." Then he gives an example. Imagine a breeze catching a piece of paper and blowing it off a table onto the floor. Is that event morally good or evil? Obviously, it is neither. This is nothing but matter and energy following natural law. It can't be moral. This is why a materialistic, naturalistic view of the world cannot result in objective moral norms of any kind. He's saying any view of the world that says everything is enclosed within our world, our universe, our natural laws and the science that then discovers that, can never come up with a set of absolutes of right and wrong. And almost as if to support that, I've got a huge number of quotes along this line, but I'll only read one. Richard Dawkins, who's a very popular contemporary atheist and popular writer, also a scientist. In his book, River Out of Eden, obviously like a lot of his stuff, he's poking fun at Christians, says, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, and other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect. If there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. So he actually is advocating the idea that there is no real justice or injustice. There is no real right or wrong. Which is kind of interesting, because when you read most of his books, he is constantly attacking believers of the Christian faith in particular for being intolerant and unfair. Now, wait a minute. If we're in a universe in which there is no such thing, it's only our false perception of it, then why is he even talking about what's unjust or unfair? For he's already said no such exists. He even is a big proponent of the idea that God ought to be put on trial for letting so much evil happen in the world, if he really exists. But again, he can't do that, because he's already said there is no such thing as good or evil. It's just the blind natural forces doing their thing. And as much as we would like to think that we choose what we do and what we don't do, he says, as do many other atheists, that we are simply the product of blind natural forces causing us to do what we do. And yet, he and many others would never in their wildest dreams want to use this same argument to justify Hitler's killing of 7 million people, or Stalin's killing of 61 million people, or Pol Pot in Southeast Asia and doing a purge of multiple tribes and races of people, or even justifying mass murderers today, or those who do horrific, terrible things in our world. They don't play by their own rules. On the one hand, they say there are no rules because there is no rule maker. And at the same time, they demand that other people respect what they believe are the rules. It just doesn't work that way. There is no true justification for any objective moral system unless there is an absolute standard or absolute lawgiver to establish it. At most, we can only say that the rules are made up by the majority or those who are in power. That was actually Stalin's argument. I'm in power, so I make the rules. You broke the rules, so you die. I have an agenda, I have something I'm trying to accomplish, and you're counter to that. And so over a period of 30 or 40 years, tens of millions of people were put to death. But is that how you justify or determine right from wrong? Let's look at the God view. Let's look at what I believe shows or points in the direction of there being an absolute lawgiver. When we turn to the Bible itself, from the very beginning, we see that even with the very first people who existed, they were told what they should and should not do. So the Bible presents this picture from the very beginning that there is a lawgiver, a supreme one who tells mankind what is right and wrong. And when they broke the laws of the lawgiver, there was punishment. There was consequences. It's like today when people violate the principles of right and wrong, even in a culture that's skewed like ours is becoming, they still pay the consequences. I doubt it would hold up in any court for a man to stand up before the judge and say, "Now, Honor, I admit I did that. I stole, I robbed, I killed, I raped, whatever." But you need to understand, Your Honor, I'm an atheist and there is no God, and I'm only doing what the blind forces of nature led me to do. I had no choice. I'm sure the judge would say, "Well, then I have no choice either. The blind forces of nature said life in prison." Is that how it works? No, that's not how it works. Everybody believes, even the atheist who claims he doesn't, that there is some basic moral rules that should govern all of mankind and their relationships to each other. In Cain and Abel, the very first murder takes place. And Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? Clearly the answer was yes. You are responsible what happens to other people because of you. The flood comes because all of mankind had become evil. Moses goes up on Mount Sinai and receives the Ten Commandments and many other laws from the giver of all laws and life. And the Ten Commandments have become the basis for many of the laws in many of the countries all around the world, even some 3,000 years later. The Sermon on the Mount by Jesus in the New Testament. There's a consistent message throughout. There is a lawgiver, and there are moral laws that all mankind are responsible for obeying. And then we read in the passage that was read to us at the beginning of our service this morning in Romans chapter 2, where the Apostle Paul says, these laws in their essence are even written on the very conscience of every person. Romans chapter 2 and verse 14. Now Paul is in the middle of a discussion about knowing right and wrong and what we're going to be held accountable to before God. And he speaks to the Jewish people who had the benefit of Moses and the Ten Commandments and all of that. But he also speaks about the non-Jewish people, the Gentiles, who didn't have Moses and who didn't have the Ten Commandments. And yet they also knew fundamentally what was right and wrong. They knew thievery was wrong. They knew murder was wrong. They knew that all of these things were wrong. Their conscience was telling them that. And so Paul says to them in Romans 2:14, indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law, talking about the law from Moses, do by nature, talking about it's innately within them, do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts accusing and now even defending them. It's only when the person chooses to not deny there's a God, logically they reach the point then saying, if there is no God, there is no absolute lawgiver. And while my culture, my society, or the majority in the place where I live may tell me this is wrong, if I choose, I can do what I wish. And Paul described that as well in chapter 1 of Romans. In verse 28, he says, furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. And although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. Now, I'm not in any way suggesting that because someone is an atheist or a non-believer in God, that they therefore are evil people in the sense that they have abandoned all morality and things that are right. That's not true. I'm just saying they're inconsistent with their own belief system if they do hold to such an absolute set of values. And I'm thankful they do hold to those values, for the world would be a much more miserable place than it can be if they didn't. And yet the Bible tells us not only has God written these basic moral laws on our consciences, He's also revealed them to us. And a day is coming, according to Revelation chapter 20 and 2 Corinthians chapter 5, it says, in which we will all stand before the judgment seat and give an answer for the things we have done in the flesh, whether good or evil. So for you, maybe the argument that there is a fundamental sense of morality and right and wrong in all mankind isn't a very convincing argument. For others, it is. And most of all, for the non-believer, for the atheist, it's a tremendous problem because they can't explain where it came from. And they can't explain why it's so consistent. They have to either resort to saying that it isn't what it appears to be, or in some other way try to justify it. And often they failed in that. So the non-believer in God has no answer, explanation, or justification for any objective standard of right and wrong. For them, they ultimately have to argue either that we as a mankind have just somehow unconsciously or subconsciously developed a common set of rules, or we just have to abandon ourselves to the law of the jungle, survival of the fittest, might makes right, and majority rules. And in truth, could not honestly condemn on any moral grounds even the most heinous acts of wickedness by others. But we innately know that that is not true. Our conscience tells us there is an objective standard of right and wrong, and that's only possible if there is a God.